Have you been missing inside the bar beyond a reasonable doubt? Did you come to believe we would never finish the case on Maurice Bentley? Your exasperation may be justified, but it cannot compare to the frustration of murder victim Michael Polite's family as the trial of their son's killer resulted in mistrial after mistrial. But in a case of art imitating life in reverse, we have pulled in the original prosecutor, Emily Puhala, to talk about how she got this train on the track and ensured that it would survive the derailments to come. Listen in. Welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, and I am here. I'm so excited because honestly, I didn't think we were ever going to finish the series on Maurice Bentley and the murder of Michael Polite, but we're actually doing it, and we have extra people, so I'm really thrilled about that. As if you've been listening to this series, you will know that I got involved very, very late in this case, but I have with me a whole group of people, and joining us via Zoom is, is it Agent Ralph Santoro?
Yeah, that's fine. Yep.
I don't know how to say all that stuff anymore. detective, whatever. And we also have former assistant district attorney Emily Puhala, which is like the big surprise. I'm really, really excited. Are you here?
Hi. Yeah. I didn't know I was a surprise.
Yeah, well, we weren't sure who else was going to be able to join, so I'm excited about that. And of course, Jenny Parker, who ended up trying this case and getting a conclusion out of it and saying words like junk really long. So we're excited to talk about this murder. I know I'm starting out like not very seriously about this just because I'm happy to see everybody, but I think we need to give some context to this murder case where a father was killed on Christmas Eve. So Rob, can you give us a little recap on what the facts of this case were?
Yeah, so I'll give short version. Basically, kind of a love triangle. Mike had a child's mother, Crystal, and he wanted to spend Christmas with her and the kids, kind of like they normally always would have. And Crystal had expressed some desires to go out with her new boyfriend, who was Maurice Bentley, that night. And Mike went out to tell Maurice to leave because Crystal was going to stay home with the family. And that escalated very quickly to the point where Maurice shot Michael multiple times. In the process of doing that, he also shot Crystal's mother, Angela, and continued to shoot Mike in the back when he was on the ground. So our forensic evidence and medical examiner evidence showed that. So yeah, really, really sad case. This case was the most trials that I've been through on a single case. And thank you to all three of you ladies for all of your contributions along the way, through that. It was very taxing on all of us. And, yeah, so that's kind of the short version, but, also a quick shout out to Kevin Rittman last time, man. What a boss, dude. Listening to his podcast was awesome, and how he did the experiments on his own, man. That's one of a kind guy, man. What a good scientist, good expert, just awesome guy.
Yeah, awesome guy. It was great to have him too. I'm glad you mentioned that because obviously all of that ballistic evidence was so important in actually getting a real final conclusion in this case. But and you know, as far as you know, all the congratulations that you're giving us, it's not just because we're sitting here like a three-judge panel that you have to. just logistically, because Rob's staring at the three of us sitting at a table. So when you guys got started, you had this case obviously from the beginning, Rob, and you'd finished up a trial. You began this investigation immediately thereafter. When did you get involved, Emily?
So that took a second. This was at first just a quote unquote regular homicide, you know, adult male suspect, adult male victim. But Maurice was a sex offender and he had run after the killing. He had fled and he was gone for a bunch of days. He had bounced around to several different places that we could identify. And so he ended up being charged with failure to register as a sex offender for not staying wherever it was he was supposed to be living. And that was kind of the easiest way to get him into jail and keep him in jail and keep probation violation, you know, to have an extra, if he were to ever get a bond on anything else, he wouldn't get a bond on that. He would stay in jail. And so all that to say, that part was my part. And then somehow I ended up with this murder that I wouldn't normally have handled because it didn't really involve kids.
Well, tell us about what your assignment was at the time. What were you supposed to be doing?
I handled crimes against children, violations of the sex offender registry, and what was the third thing? Physical abuse cases. So sexual abuse and physical abuse, and then registry cases.
That's a pretty huge caseload.
It was not great.
I just job in the office.
By far. And then here's... I mean, it's so hard that it took how many people to replace you?
Well, as it probably needed to. Yeah,
just one to start with.
That's true.
To start with. And she did a great job.
Yeah. One being Jenny, just in case anybody's wondering.
So, but then two, and it probably needs three people.
Couldn't stand to have three. But so, you know, Rob ended up continuing to do all of the heavy lifting because this wasn't the type of murder I was familiar with. It wasn't the type of case I was familiar with. You know, sex offender cases or child abuse cases don't rely a lot on things like cell phones and don't have a lot of bullets. And so he really had to walk me through a lot of it, especially at the beginning.
I was so excited though, like, because Emily, this was our, like, we knew each other, but this was like our first real case together. And, We'll touch a little bit on the personal relationship here. So John Pujal is your husband. And
right.
So he and I worked very closely together in homicide. And of course, that's kind of how we knew each other. And so, yeah, I was like super excited to have a case with you.
Right. And then there's some really personal stuff that comes up when we start talking about the actual trial of the case, because our first child was right there with me as we tried it the first few times.
Yep.
That ended up playing into it. And the timing and some of the scheduling of all of this. So
crazy. I have forgotten that part of it.
I had too, honestly. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah.
She was full on pregnant, man.
I was. In fact, this was the last.
Not just a little bit.
No, this was like my suits don't fit pregnant. And this was the last case I tried in the office before I left.
Wow. Really? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Wow. All right. So tell us about how. First of all, you had to do a bunch of things to get this case ready for trial. Was there anything exceptional other than, you know, like learning the entire case? Was there anything that stood out to you that like was a problem?
Asking me or asking him? You know, really, other than I looked at it more as a typical Savannah homicide. You had a lot of people you couldn't get a hold of. You had people that had moved. You had people that had a lot of amnesia and didn't really, you know, the did you say her name already? Crystal, the the mother, the girlfriend involved here, you know, for obvious reasons and adding in trauma and all of the things. And I'm drawing a blank. They have at least four kids. They had at least four kids together. You know, and her mom did not recover well from the gunshot and was in a lot of pain all the time and had been, you know, really one of her major supports. It was just hard. It was hard to bring people in to talk to them. It was hard to get people on the phone to keep them updated. It was hard to track them if any new information came up to like ask questions of them. Of course, nobody, all of the places he had gone after, you know, when he had fled, none of them, you know, wanted to help us out and tell us anything that he had been up to while he was on the run there. And so there weren't a ton of people involved. I think we had one neighbor who had like heard shots, but it was something, she was way off on her estimation, so it wasn't helpful. And so you really had to have Crystal and Angela and
their sister, the sister who's involved.
Her name Kim.
Yeah.
And there's so much I would not have been able to take that 5 seconds. but yes.
Wasn't there a witness that saw the car drive away or drive by?
Who there was a guy.
Yeah, that was Charles. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he initially thought it was a woman because of the hair.
That was JJ's guy.
Yeah.
JJ's best friend.
Yeah. So there was a lot riding on this very small group of people who, you know, just had so much other stuff going on and so many other factors.
You talk about trauma, and I think, you know, it's worthwhile to mention that you work very closely with people who have been involved in trauma even now. So you have a lot of background in, you know, all of the recognition of and the interviewing of people who have experienced trauma. Did that come into play for you in this case?
It did. And I, you know, of course, wish I knew then what I know now. And I wish the same thing in another 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that she was trying to bury her head in the sand.
Crystal.
I guess was Crystal. Yeah. That was the biggest. Angela was sweet and helpful and honestly just kind of didn't know enough. You know, I wanted her to be able to give more facts and more information, and
she only knows what she knows. I never felt like Angela was withholding anything.
No. And Crystal had so, I think she was the type of person who already maybe didn't tell everybody everything about what she was doing. You know, she kind of seemed to like her freedom. And then obviously this is a bad look. It's a bad situation. You know, people could blame her. She was going to try to avoid that. She just wasn't forthcoming, even about easy stuff.
Well, and you talk about, like, not forthcoming and feeling like it was on her. I mean, there had to be some sense of responsibility, but the father of your children is dead in the front yard on Christmas.
Because your new sex offender boyfriend shot him.
Yeah. Someone in front of your children.
Yeah.
And also shot your mom.
And shot your mom.
Yeah. It was not.
Well, and, you know, I don't remember if it was the first time I tried it or the second time, but one of those times the defense really picked at them about not remembering exactly where the three ladies were standing when the shot was fired.
I know that happened when I was present.
Okay.
So it happened every time.
That was probably, it was probably in the last trial that I'm remembering it then. And you know, when people go through something traumatic like that, sometimes they don't remember little details like that. And it's to be expected.
Absolutely. And we also talk about that with kid cases all the time of like, well, why can't you remember that Tuesday afternoon when you say this started? Because it was a Tuesday afternoon. I went to school, I came home, I got a snack. But then this other thing happened. Like, I wasn't paying attention to anything before that because it hadn't happened yet. It wasn't, none of that was
important.
It was
just a normal day.
I didn't know I had to, like, remember every detail of that specific moment because I didn't know it was about to be like the trauma of my life, right? Like I didn't know it was going to happen, so I wasn't really too keyed in.
But everything after that is probably fairly clear. Well, and that, but the thing is, it is
sometimes,
but like sometimes in this case, it isn't because you've got so much chaos. And you know, honestly, Rob, you can probably speak to that more than anybody else. You're there in the middle of the chaos.
Yeah, and that scene was like it was chaos. I remember like being there with Alan and just Sammons and just like kind of like looking at each other and, you know, we're still trying to like really get the scene under control. And, you know, like being there and again, I don't remember which trial this was. It was probably all of them, but like
they run together.
The whole inference of like the family came up with this to blame Maurice, like collectively in like the 5 minutes it took for us to, and that's when we had to time it all out to the last, you know, the last trial. We had like the timing of the 911 to the time the first officer got there. We had it all down because it was like, dude, there's no way. Like we got there and you saw what it was like. If like you got there and saw what it was like, and that's why body cameras are sometimes so good. Cause it's like, you know, nowadays you just play the body camera and you just see the mass chaos when the first officer gets there and you're like, yeah, dude, they're not concocting some scheme, right? Like their mother shot, the father shot, like they're not thinking about, oh, who do we blame this on? They're like, oh my God, like he's dead, she's bleeding out, like I need help.
People are freaking out, you know?
Crystal's having an asthma attack, you know, like just
And
crazy.
do I remember right that Crystal, they had also been out that day, like that she was just getting back to the house
Yes.
herself. So who knows
Yes.
if she'd been drinking or if she'd slept or, you know, all of those other things that play into memory and,
Yeah.
you know, coordination and whatever else.
Well, and you mentioned body cam. I mean, I know Jenny's got a ton of experience arguing this with the Georgia Supreme Court. Like, even in the best of circumstances, and you have body cam, they can say, oh, it's too prejudicial because it's so chaotic, or there's blood, or there's whatever. And so
Your
that can.
evidence is too evidency.
Yeah. Yeah.
How dare you, like, actually show a crime scene? Oh my God, you know, it's so there's just so many factors in what you're actually able to present to a jury, and it all can be dependent on someone like Crystal. And so it that I'm sure had to factor into how this case played out at trial. So, tell us about this first trial, Emma.
Well, the first trial,
The first
the
trial,
very first
number
one, the trial
one.
that never was.
Yeah.
Well, the
Yeah,
very first.
you didn't have any revocation hearings on this, did you?
No, we ended up holding the revocation,
Okay.
knowing that we were going to try it. What ended up happening was that before trial, but relatively late in the process, Wamsley, Judge Wamsley severed the sex offender counts. And the revocation was based on those. And so we never ended up having a hearing before that of any real evidentiary issues. So then we were left with the murder count, and then whatever else went along with that, aggravated assault, and I don't even know what else. And the very first trial was, we went all the way through, we picked a jury. It was relatively normal, I thought. It was, you know, John Rodman was John Rodman, and he
He was the
wasn't,
defense attorney,
he was the defense attorney, and I had tried a bunch of cases with him and his cohorts before, and he was
doing
normal
his
Rodman.
thing.
Yeah,
Yeah.
nothing completely out of the ordinary.
Pulling on his suspenders.
Yeah, he's a good Southern gentleman. And it was fine. And then the jury was sworn, and then he, oops, made mention that I had left a witness off of the witness list, and he couldn't possibly go forward without this knowledge of this witness, who was the medical examiner, whose report he had, who he's cross-examined 20 times before.
Are you
No, no
serious?
unfair surprise.
Yeah.
Who he could probably have guessed was going to testify.
No unfair
Who I had
surprise.
referenced in my all of my pretrial stuff, and who's in every report that we gave him. And so, I mean, Judge Wamsley declared a mistrial, and you know, it wasn't going to be a big deal, other than it's annoying to pick a second jury and, you know, have some of your cards already on the table. But then Detective Santoro is very busy and very popular, and he was going to be in training the week after. We were gonna get reset for just a couple of days later, but then
Oops.
Santoro was leaving like what would have become mid-trial, and so we ended up getting pushed for a couple of months, I think. For several weeks at least. And so we ended up trying it. And by that point, then I really was visibly pregnant and much slower. And we came back and we started all over again.
I always think it is stupid to try a case against a pregnant prosecutor. I just can't imagine like that's going to work well for you, especially in a case like this where there are children who at least heard, if not saw, some of the events.
What's funny is you actually said that to me at the time, because after the second
Did
mistrial, yeah, I was like, well, God, can we just get it reset? Like, I don't want to try to do this. And actually, that's what ended up happening. This was one of the cases that would have been set for trial the week that I was like 37 weeks. And I was like,
Oh,
Judge,
wow.
I just, like, I cannot do that. And so then Jenny got to take the reins.
Yeah.
But I remember you saying that. I was like, why can we not get this, you know, over the finish line? And you said, nobody likes a pregnant prosecutor.
Nobody likes a pregnant prosecutor. It's true. I mean, I had a murder that was scheduled for when I was massively pregnant. And he ended up taking the plea because June Fogle was his attorney. And she's like, we're not doing this. Not going to work.
But yeah, then we started the second round, and I don't remember anything being particularly egregious coming from Rodman. It was fairly standard fare for him until the witnesses started testifying.
And was the defense theory in that one the Crystal did it thing?
So as it turns out, yes, but he didn't give it away until Crystal was on the stand. I don't remember what he said in opening, but it did not touch on, he may have said like some other dude did it, but he never put the gun in Crystal's hand until he was talking to her.
Which is why you file some other dude did it motion that apparently is considered to be unheard of in other counties. But I file all the time.
No.
Saudi motion.
It sounds like something that shouldn't even
be. It is, though. It is. I want a certain judge turn his or her nose up at me when I refer to it as a Saudi defense. And I was like, that's what the appeals courts call it. I didn't make it up. That's what they call it.
I remember that all the way back from law school.
Exactly. I mean, that's a real thing. Some other dude did it as a defense.
Yeah, I didn't make up that silly acronym.
But you have to jump certain hurdles before it is admissible before a jury. And you file the motion so you can smoke them out. Now, of course, you have to have a reason to think that they're going to say something like that.
See, up until then, the defense had been self-defense.
Right? And that makes sense in this case. Right.
It does. And this may not be the right
thing. That's what you'd expect in this case.
It would be self-defense. At most, like some kind of voluntary manslaughter.
Right.
You know, I did it, but I didn't really mean to, or it was an accident, or I have a crime of passion, you know.
Whatever. A voluntary manslaughter conviction in this case would not have been unexpected.
Right. No.
There was anger, and
they were having a fight. Passion. That's what it was all about.
Do not be confused, listeners, or defendant's family. This is a straight up murder.
Especially because he like pulled out his 380 to Crystal beforehand and was like, if he gets uppity, I'm gonna do what I gotta do.
Yeah, exactly.
Before he came out.
There is no question in my mind that this is a murder.
Yeah.
But you can see how a jury, if they're not believing any of the witnesses or they're struggling, could wind up with a voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Compromise.
But there was absolutely malice here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everything about it was malicious.
Yes.
As the fourth and final jury found in about 30 minutes.
Finally got it.
Amen.
Yeah.
But so you go to trial, Robin's doing his thing, Crystal gets on the stand, and what happened with Crystal? I mean, I wasn't there, I only read transcripts. So how was she acting on the stand? Do you remember?
I do. So the thing that you have to understand about Crystal is she's about 5'1", 80 pounds. She looks like a child on the witness stand. You could barely see up to her shoulders when she's sitting there. She talks, you know, low. And I always thought, and maybe this was just my own reading of it, her mom and her sister to me were much more similar than she was. And honestly, her mom, her sister, and Mike were much more similar and had much more, you know, her sister looks more like her mom. They dressed more alike. They spoke more alike. And Mike seemed to fit in with them. And then Crystal just kind of didn't. And she looked sadder and more world weary, and like I said, she's a lot smaller. Her just whole demeanor was that her life had been hard.
Well, she's in her 20s with four kids.
Yeah, exactly. Her life had been hard on
and her boyfriend shot her children's father. Yeah. I mean, that's a lot.
But so then when Rodman pulled out the "it was your gun, wasn't it" card, you know, you could kind of see how somebody would go down that road with him, because it was a little bit of like, which one of these is not like the other? And she kind of fit more with Bentley than she did with her mom and her sister. And that
she was rebellious. Definitely. There's no question about that. She's the rebellious sibling for sure.
And she was so shocked, of course, by what he was saying to her that she couldn't, you know, mount a verbal assault against him.
I'd be angry if someone accused me of killing the father of my children.
You'd be angry and say, "Oh hell no, I didn't."
No, well, I know there might be an F word in there. It's just maybe, like, man, fuck you.
She was like flummoxed, though. She didn't give any sort of coherent answer. She didn't give any sort of coherent
denial. Because she wanted to say, "Man, fuck you," and she's in front of a jury, and she can't.
And probably in shock that she's being accused. You know, I mean, I'm sure that was the last thing she expected.
Yes.
Get on the stand.
And honestly, as the attorney, I probably should have protected her better, but I was in shock.
Yeah.
Like, this is not where I thought that they were going. This is not something we had ever talked about, you know, fending off.
Well, and how do you can't object to, wasn't this your gun as a question? You can't object to that. It's a legit question.
And that was part of the problem with this particular case, through no fault of Santoro's, because he had fled for so long, there was so much information that we didn't have about the gun, about its provenance.
We had those hair clippers, though. Those hair clippers were pivotal.
He's hiding who he is.
That's right. He tried to change his appearance.
Consciousness of guilt.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Better.
And that crystal stuff was junk.
But so Rodman had a lot of wiggle room, because, you know, we didn't have a lot of cold, hard facts to say, like, he's just making stuff up. And he just kind of went to town with it.
Well, I mean, she has to, and she's honestly saying, "Well, I had a 380 once, you know."
Yeah, and that was the first time that ever came out, was like on the stand where she said that. So we were like, "Oh shit."
No. Well, and you know, I do not want to delve into the bowels of history, but Christy and I had tried a case against Rodman's partner about 6 months before this. Oh,
I forgot about that.
That,
oh god, we need to talk about that some other time, but yes, oh my god,
horrible case.
Because something came up about that in my head recently,
so the same type of thing happened, that the girl's dad got on the stand and just started spouting off stuff
nobody knew
before.
Nobody knew.
That was extremely damning, and but not disprovable. It was just information out there in the ether, and
probably, you know, that case certainly should not have been admissible. This case, you know, it's admissible whether she had a 380 at some point in time. But what she did with it, of course, she couldn't account for. She couldn't. I think she was so flustered, and she's so young. I mean, you know, you're sitting there on the stand getting confronted with this, like, out of the blue. I don't know that I remember exactly what I did with some. Gun.
Well, then, it was like the answers were like, "Well, I don't have it anymore." "Well, where is it?" "I don't know. I got rid of it." But it's like, that wasn't a lie. That was true. But it was like, sounds horrible. And, you know, it was like, and we ended up being able to figure that out later on in the later trials. Yeah. But like in that first one, it was like, "Ooh, it does not look good."
Well, the actual facts didn't sound that great either. I had a fight with Mike and he threw it in the woods. It didn't sound great either.
Yeah, but it was in like 2011 or something like that.
Yes, fortunately.
Oh,
but
my God.
Yeah, I mean, this was just kind of that office's tactic at the time, was just to like throw bombshells that were, legally speaking, at least kind of legitimate. And
I mean, it was a good tactic.
It worked.
It worked twice.
Well, and the thing about it in this case particularly, so, you know, of course, I'm this objective, because I'm not I'm way up in the far reaches. But you know, it worked in part because no one had the ability to respond to it, but it also worked because a juror is going to hang on to anything that sounds reasonable as a doubt, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because they're instructed to, they're told over and over. You know, could someone else have done this? Then you need to say it's an acquittal. And, you know, in this case, which was so clear cut and it was so obvious and so everything, I mean, thank God they didn't acquit. I mean, seriously.
Well, there was overwhelming evidence on the other side. I mean, we're talking big about like this argument, but like, really though, like you got, like she's gonna shoot her mom too, you know? Like I don't know. Just, yeah. Like,
well, and honestly, if her mom hadn't been shot, I think it might have been a very different case.
Yeah,
her mom getting shot was almost
true.
Good. I mean, terrible facts.
Not good. For
real her. Nice, Emily. Good for real nice.
Good for getting him behind bars.
Yeah.
And there's also the factor, like we say this all the time with kid cases and why so many molesters get acquitted. Like at the end of the day, jurors just do not want to believe in monsters.
They don't.
And they would rather believe in accidents or misunderstandings or, you know, and just any kind of easier explanation than that there are some people who need to be removed.
Yeah. Well, right. And the difference with a murder is that they can't refute that somebody's dead.
Mm-hmm.
And this person is responsible for that death. And you, nobody likes dead bodies. Nobody. I mean, you're not going to get past that. Nobody likes people being victims of rape either. But that misunderstanding thing, you can, or even with an aggravated assault, you can make the argument, oh, this victim is confused, is whatever, you know. Misunderstood my intentions, something, even if you're shooting at them, fine, or you needed shooting at, or something. There's always something with a live victim that is not the same when you have a murder case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it makes it easier for the most part. It also makes it harder because you don't have their side of the story, the victim's side of the story at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to speak for them.
Yeah, and you know, this case was never a whodunit. So it's not like y'all were out looking at who else in the family owned guns, because we knew from the beginning who did it.
Yeah.
The reality, too, with this case and with like all of these cases, really, is that there's so much work that goes into understanding people and victims and witnesses and that mindset that they're facing when they come into the courtroom. And it's not like we all make it easier, because we don't. I mean, it's like, I don't know about you all, but at various points, I'm sure that every victim's family hated me. Because you cannot make the experience of reliving this horrific event easy.
Yeah, you don't actually get what you want from the justice system. People don't find out that until they get in there.
No.
It doesn't make people come back. It doesn't make them whole. It doesn't make them happy.
We can't undo it.
We can't undo it. And then they get mad.
No, we can't give you your child back.
No.
We can't give you your husband back or the father to your children. You can't do it.
You can't give your life back. Your what you had before.
The best we can do when we're lucky is get justice for them.
Yeah. Right. And hold the person responsible, accountable. I mean, that's what the justice system is. It is not complete justice. And sometimes it is what my husband refers to as justice with a little J. I mean, we get the big J, but there is justice with a little J. And, you know, often that involves like someone getting jumped at the jail or something. But you know, that is a different kind of accountability than what we're involved with. What we're involved with is kind of getting you off the streets, like you said, Emily. I mean, no one wants to even think about, mm-hmm. oh, there are monsters among us, like that you are encountering every day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there are. I mean, the overwhelming number of people we prosecute are just normal people that did something dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what most of them are, people who made a mistake. But we have all prosecuted people that we knew were just dangerous and evil, and that most of the time those people have a string of people behind them that they got hurt.
Yes. Well, and obviously I didn't have you on, Jenny, because I couldn't at the time, but we had Norman Smart as an example.
Speaking of evil people that have a string of people behind them that they have hurt.
Right. I mean, at some point we probably need to talk about that too, but you look at, you're right. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, I've only had two drinks, or I've only had one DUI. It's like, no, you've had a bunch of DUIs. You just got caught this time.
Yeah, the average is, at least back in the day, it was like 80.
80?
Before somebody gets caught.
Really? Wow.
I don't know how they study that. Where how they come up with that number.
Wow.
I'm sure it's just urban legend.
Yeah. I've heard that statistic before too, but I have no idea how they study that. I mean, do they interview people who get DUIs and say,
how
many
people
I drink this number of times per week and I drive this number of times.
Yeah, I have no idea how they come up.
Oh, God. But in any case, what we were talking about is how many crimes people commit that they don't get prosecuted for before you get them on anything. I mean, it's pretty rare that someone who commits murder is the first thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
But
I remember.
We have a few of those because they're young.
They're
young and they start off with a big, big mistake.
I do remember being frustrated with Maurice, though, that there wasn't more to use in his background. And, like, I will admit, his sex offense, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was not impressive. It was something.
It was rape and incest on his sister.
Oh, maybe. Okay, take that back.
Yeah, he raped his sister.
Yeah, sure, right.
No, it was incest.
Yeah, it was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a bad crime that was useful.
Yeah.
Against him.
Right, yeah, I remember they brought that up post-conviction, the fact that I had tendered, or you had tendered, one of us had tendered the conviction, and it wasn't redacted, and I always, because I'm always arguing the law when it's me, on my portion of whatever closing argument there is, I talk about the law, and possession of a firearm by convicted felon was something on that, and so I'm sure I said, and incest is a felony. And there's like, she's just rubbing it in, and it's prejudicial and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but neither one of us harped on the facts of it in closing. And we did not go near that line at all.
Mm-mm.
I do remember having motions about that beforehand, now that you say that. Yeah. That none of the facts could come in, and everybody was very concerned about
how prejudicial incest was. Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty prejudicial.
It is.
He shouldn't have done it.
And you should. Just in case you're wondering.
He shouldn't have done it. People don't like people that do bad things like that.
They don't. They don't.
They don't.
So you go through this whole trial, Emily, and you got Crystal in shock. What happened at closing? How were your jurors looking? Could you even tell at that point that they weren't going to convict, or did they look confused?
I don't think I felt I felt a confusion. I don't think I felt like anybody was, lean back, arms crossed. I hate everything you're saying. Because I think it was still confusing. He didn't get enough out of her to be able to really point the finger at her. He just stirred the pot.
Yeah.
And it was very maybe what, huh? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. And, I'm glad they didn't acquit, but I was not surprised that they hung.
Well, and Crystal is not the sort of witness that you would want to recall to clear things up.
No. No, it did not get better.
You want to get her up and out as quickly as you can.
Because how does she react? I mean, when this comes up, because a lot of times you'll be able to talk to a witness, or they're out in the hallway or whatever. Did you talk to her after?
JJ did. She had a decent relationship with JJ. And JJ had a good relationship with her mom, her victim witness coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
People usually find me unpleasant and scary.
Really? Yes. That never happens to me. What are you talking about?
I'm not surprised with you, but yeah,
she's pointing at me. But most
people tend to find me scary, and I don't remember talking to her while the trial was still going on after she had testified. I would have sent JJ to like, don't worry about it. It is what it is. We're just going to keep going. We're going to keep fighting.
All the years I work with you, I am shocked to hear that people find you to be unpleasant.
I'm surprised by that too. I mean, it's a given with me. So I'm really, you know, if the two of us are present, they're going to like you better. I think.
It's relative.
Emily, I see your demeanor as being more like mine, and I don't think I'm scary at all.
I don't think you're scary, but you're scary too. I can get kind of mean. I'm not very good at not showing my frustration, and I know I was frustrated enough to
I had no game face.
To her.
Yeah.
In that moment. So yeah, I'm sure I sort of.
I'm only scared when I say junk.
Or beat the hell out of him.
Yeah.
Out of her. Yeah.
I'm only scary for about 20 minutes of every trial.
But you're always like on point scary.
It's the like, in the moment scary where you need to be. Yes. I was just scary when I'm sitting around.
Anyway, you're not sure. Not when you're just sitting around.
Okay. But anyway, so you have this mistrial. Was it JJ's responsibility to tell them like, oh shit, we got to do this again?
It was, and because it didn't get immediately rescheduled, it really wasn't, everything, you know, had time to settle out, and it wasn't, nobody was on fire.
It may have even been continued once before I ended up trying it the first time.
Because you probably would have, well, yeah, because it would have gotten continued right before I left the office, which would have been 3 months later. Wait, we tried it in May, June, July, August, 4 months later, it came up again. And then I got Judge Walmsley to continue it again because I just could not do it at that late date. And so then it would have been another cycle after
and
that.
I got it. Wow. And, of course, I thought, you know, your jury was just a fluke. You know, it's such a good case.
Well, Rob said that.
Shooting with three witnesses. You know, we never have murders with three cooperative eyewitnesses. You just don't have that, you know?
Yeah. And then the other thing he did, Rodman, besides, you know, throw shade on Crystal, was the whole like SWAT team stuff, because we ended up so we had used the SWAT team when we figured out kind of where Maurice might have been laying his head. Sammons was able to locate the car and keep eyes on it, and of course, you know, we had to use a SWAT team. It fit the matrix for us, the threshold for us to use them on a search warrant execution, because he was a murder suspect. We had murder warrants for him. The gun was still outstanding, all of this stuff. You know, he's already a convicted felon. And so we did a search warrant there with the SWAT team at that house. Maurice wasn't there, but it was like his cousin's house, and they had a few smaller kids. I say teenage kids. And so that was all like just normal business, right? Like that was normal business for us. And we would do that again. Even if I had to do it all over again today, it would all be the same. But when we got to that trial, like Ferguson, Missouri had just happened. And so there was all this like just political sentiment and popular public opinion sentiment about police brutality and police use of force and militarization of police, and all the same issues we're discussing today.
Yeah.
And but it was like super, like that whole, it was a stoked conversation at that point, and he
fresh and people were mad.
So he did a good job of playing that up. I mean, he just wouldn't let go of Crystal and the 380 and then the SWAT team, and you know, these kids are going to be traumatized, and that's what he hung his defense on, was those two things.
And that woman, I had forgotten about that woman,
Erica Johnson.
Oh my God. I mean, give her her Oscar. Like, she
testified. So this is Maurice Bentley's cousin?
Yes.
Was she the cousin, or she was in the house? And I mean,
yeah,
she's
the cousin. Yeah.
That, like, you would have thought she was in Iraq in 2003. Like,
yeah,
it was just this beautiful testimony about the windows exploding and the children screaming and the lights flashing and the smoke blaring. And, like, I mean, top notch performance. Oh. She didn't cry. She, like, yeah, but.
So people don't think that's an accurate description of what actually happened. What actually happened when the warrant was served?
So, you know, I'm sure there probably was a flashbang that's used for, it's a diversionary device to basically kind of delay anybody in the house from having time to realize sort of what's going on before they can react and act. So it's just a sensory thing. And then I want to say they probably breached the door and then did a call out. Cause I think at that point they were doing surround call outs. And you know, the kids were called out and they were called out. Or maybe they were called to like one room in the house or something like that. I can't remember exactly how they did it, but, you know, I'm sure it was like there was probably some windows breaking. There was probably a flashbang. But nobody was hurt during this whole process. You know, the kids weren't handcuffed. Like, it was strictly only done that way because, like, this dude just murked a guy on Christmas in front of his kids and shot him in the back when he was down. We knew all that information. So,
and he had actually been in that house. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he had. His car was there. His stuff was there.
He had been staying at that house.
Yeah,
his vehicle was all the flat tires.
And I'm sure it was scary for them, but
also you're letting him stay there.
Well, right. You're harboring a murderer. Yeah. What exactly is it that you think is going to happen in these circumstances?
Yeah.
Well, and then the other thing too is.
Well, actually, they would have known by then
that he was
lying. Because the information was out by then.
Yeah, I think we put it on the news and all that stuff. Yeah. And, you know, he cut his hair and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, like, the other thing is, like, you know, for the case itself, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like the information was out there. And this is all hindsight stuff, but I want to say, like, loosely, we were able to eventually recover the gun. And it was involved in, like, some incident where, like, the 15-year-old kid, so he was, like, 15 at the time. It was like he was involved in it somehow. And so, like, odds are is like he gave the murder weapon to the kid and the kid had the gun for a couple years before we were able to recover it later on and all that stuff, which we recovered Crystal's gun too. Like, I think we ended up getting all the guns, but, you know, so like odds are is that gun was at that house at some point. So, I mean, it is what it is, but yeah, I mean, just cause a kid's 15 doesn't mean he's not capable of violence either. Like, you know, still a pending murder down there right now where the kid was 15 when he killed a guy.
Yeah.
No, that's not the first one.
Yeah. There are a lot. The youngest one I know went to trial, the youngest defendant went to trial was 13 for killing somebody.
I tried that.
Yeah. Well, you had one. There was another one before that John Hope had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had a 13-year-old. One of the saddest cases I ever tried.
God, that was the Sunrise Villas, right?
Yeah. Yes. Such a sad case. 13-year-old commits a murder of a 15-year-old.
Mm. Over nothing.
I don't remember. Yeah.
Over nothing. I mean,
Well, that made us all serious, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Because we take this
so sad.
And I think that everybody should take it seriously. But when we're talking about the life of this case, though, you know, the fact that you didn't get a conviction the first go around, that it is a hung jury, what is the approach the second time around? I know you said you felt like it was a fluke, Jenny. What did you try to do differently, if anything?
Well, so when we tried it for what was the third time, my first time, I had filed a motion in limine to keep out information about Crystal's gun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then after hearing some evidence, the judge changed her mind and decided to allow that evidence in mid-trial. And
this is a different judge at this point.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Different judge. And I mean, I still thought it's just such a strong case. I really still didn't think it would be a problem. And then we had another mistrial with a hung jury. And so before we tried it that last time, we did everything. We chased down every possible answer to any question that there could be.
How much time are we talking about?
How long after?
I don't remember.
It was a good stretch.
There was a few months in there because we had time to do some things. Kevin Rittman did some work.
Right. Because I remember, like, after that mistrial again, you asked me to help. And that it had to be a couple of months in there because I know that I have a feeling that you just said, like, hey, you know, you are dealing, I had been dealing with the firearms guys a lot, ballistics guys a lot. And so I kind of went and sat down with Kevin and mm-hmm. just was like, look, what can you do? And he'd already done a bunch of stuff. I just was like, oh, great.
Yeah.
So that was fabulous. And I'm a little concerned. Yeah, I'm a little concerned we've got Rob frozen here. So perhaps, dude.
Oh, we lost him. He'll be back in a second.
No, he'll be back.
There he is. Okay. And then Santoro or Sammons, I can't remember which one of y'all did it. One of you tracked down the police report from where Mike had thrown Crystal's gun in the woods.
I think it was Rob.
I checked down. I think I got that report from Rich Bell, and then we also got the e-trace from the ATF where they actually dug up where the gun was purchased, what kind of gun it was, mm-hmm. when it was purchased, all that stuff.
Yep.
Right, and that fed into the additional questions I was able to ask Kevin. You know, like, hey, can you make some sort of Frankenstein gun out of these parts that would actually fire? And the answer was no. You know, which made such a huge difference, I think. You know, they couldn't make an argument where Crystal's gun was involved in this. And yeah, you know, that you're freezing, my friend.
We lost him for a second.
Have we lost you?
I'm just gonna kill my video, and that way hopefully it doesn't you can hear me all right?
Yeah.
All right, so I think like some of it's like we had done it so many times that we were able to close some doors on the defense, but like it was also like persistence. Like I just feel like that last trial, the defense, any fight they had in them was just gone. Like it, you know, of course it switched lawyers too a couple times, but like I don't know, like can you really get up and get a fire under you to try it the fourth time? And I mean that was even hard for us, but I think we also like we outwilled them towards the end, you know, where they just
we weren't giving up.
No,
that it just made me mad and more determined because we knew from the night it happened. We knew what happened.
And there's no question. Something like that kind of defense or that kind of shot that they took only works as a surprise.
Right.
You,
yeah.
You
that's
can't,
true.
You can't go back and use it over and over and over again.
Yeah. So we thought in the first case I tried, I thought I had closed off that avenue and then that didn't work out. So the second time we made sure it was closed off. And I think Crystal was a little more prepared because we knew to expect it.
Yeah. Well, and nobody lied to her. And it's not like anybody had lied to her at any point in time, but you made it clear up front. You know this is coming.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep coming at you and keep coming at you. And the biggest and most important thing is to keep your cool.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to rattle you and make you look like the bad guy here. And you know you're not. I know you're not.
Because even if, you know, they can't get anybody to buy that she did it, you can get a lot of mileage just out of getting them to hate her. And she's already in a position of not being particularly sympathetic. And sometimes the distractions
I found her sympathetic. Like,
Personally, yes, but the circumstances I don't find terribly sympathetic. Like, I'd rather go out with my sex offender boyfriend on Christmas Eve than spend it with my kids. Oh, that does not come across well.
No, but when you look at it like this, she was a woman in her 20s who had four kids. And she was living in a house with a lot of people. It was already like 9 or 10 o'clock at night. The kids were going to bed. It wasn't her avoiding spending time with her kids. It's that she didn't want to spend time with Mike, who was her ex at that point. She wanted to go out. Now, her choice of who to go out with was not good.
Obviously.
But, I mean, you can understand a young woman living in a house with family with four kids wanting to get out. I mean, that part of it is sympathetic to me.
Yeah, I mean, I see your argument, but I can also see the other side of it. If you are the crux of why this man's not breathing. And that makes it harder.
I think I never saw it that way. Like,
the person who's responsible is Maurice Bentley.
Maurice Bentley is always the reason that he's not breathing,
Right.
I just was afraid of the destruction. Of like, going down a rabbit hole of...
I think after two trials of them beating up on Crystal, it made me feel really protective of her.
Fair.
And so, you know, people would want to portray her as being like a bad mom. And I can remember in that last closing taking up for her and saying,
yeah, you did.
You know, she's leaving her children who are little and going to bed in a home with their grandmother and their aunt. It's not like she's, you know, leaving her kids in the street to go party.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and their dad's there.
And their dad.
Their dad, their aunt, and their grandmother.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not. It didn't strike me as bad parenting. It just was an interesting choice for a Christmas Eve.
Well, and it, you know, her motivations too could have been like she broke up with Mike and. Here Mike is at her house on Christmas Eve.
That part was a little, you know, strange.
And I can see it from his side too. He wants his family together. Yeah. It's the holidays. But from her perspective, he's her ex.
Yeah. At her house.
Yeah, but the problem is that then you start like giving her motive to shoot him.
That's what I was
careful with that.
That's what I was always afraid of though, of like, you know, just a little too.
She didn't want to hurt him. She just wanted to get away.
Yeah.
She just wanted to get out.
Understood.
I'm just thinking of like how hard it is for us though to like do it four times. Like, I just think of Mike's dad. Like, he was at every trial, man. He was like one of the nicest men like in the whole world, man. And like, I just think of that, and I think about like just how slow the justice system is sometimes, and how like, yeah, you just see like things from outside of a case really impact it, whether it's, you know, just fabricated stuff about, well, I mean, Crystal did own a 380, but like fabricated stuff, like it wasn't anywhere close to the scene on that night. It wasn't relevant to what we were investigating. And like the whole like Ferguson, Missouri stuff was totally irrelevant. And just to see how much that can impact it. And I mean, imagine like, I mean, I don't know if you're him, how do you, I mean, I guess we got it right at the end, but, or the jury did, but it's just like, how do you not lose faith? And like, just like, well, what the fuck, you know, like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you're right. You're absolutely right for him. But you also have like Angela, the mom, the grandmother in this circumstance. Yeah. Here's someone who was shot doing nothing other than trying to break up the verbal argument.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she also has to take care of her grandkids and support her, you know, daughter who's lost the father of her children, and you know, she's got so much going on herself that it's so hard to articulate for a jury all the things that are going on, especially the way the justice system is structured. Like, there's a lot of stuff you can't talk about because it's considered prejudicial, or you know, you can't try to garner sympathy for people who have been through all of this crap. It's like, okay, it's not sympathy. It's a fact though, that affects their credibility, that affects their demeanor in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And you know, we've got to be able to talk about at least some of it.
Yeah.
And there's also, like, I always, prosecutors are human, police are human. We have to maintain our lives. We have to, you know, take time to rest, whatever else. But, like, I always felt some type of way that, like, these people waited 6 extra months because I was having a baby. You know, they waited 2 extra months because I forgot to write somebody's name down. Like, stuff like that just kind of tears you up and can be really distracting. You know, you really have to keep your head in the game. And
yeah, it's hard. Get it's past hard. The job isn't easy. And I do think that that gets lost in the shuffle too.
Yeah, they're both jobs, being a police officer or a prosecutor, where you're not allowed to make mistakes. Yeah,
right.
You can't make mistakes.
Right.
And that's a stressful part of what we do, is you can't make mistakes. The ramifications of a mistake can be life altering for people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It can be catastrophic.
Absolutely. We're very somber right now.
and we started out kind of want to, you know, I do think it's important that we think about these victims and what it is that this job is intended to be, and how to make that a reality. You know, people have expectations of what we do, and it's our responsibility to do our best to live up to them. Obviously, you know, you only do the best you can in any moment. And we got it right eventually, and that's that not giving up.
Yeah.
Not giving up at all. My cat wants to be part of the podcast. He can't help himself.
The cat has been quiet since the cat was fed.
Yes, sure. He's been pretty good.
Yeah, this was definitely a case that was, like, so easy it became difficult.
Well, right. I mean, you worry, like, I've overthought this. That's why it's suddenly become hard.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, that is really very true. So any closing thoughts, Emily? Do you have something that people should take away from this?
I mean, I'm glad you guys carried it across the line and kept going with it, because, you know, there have only been a handful of people that I came into contact with in that job that, you know, another one this reminds me of, he was walking down Abercorn one day and just punched a lady in the face and broke her jaw. Total stranger, you know, never seen her before, no provocation, nothing. And I would put Bentley in that category. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he...
No conscience.
And he had to be off the street. People had to be protected from him. Mm-hmm. You know, and whatever your thoughts about retribution or rehabilitation or restorative, you know, whatever kind of justice you're looking for. I remember Greg Jacobs saying to me years ago that, like, there are just some people who cannot be out.
Yes.
Right.
There are people like Bentley that have to have specific deterrence.
Yes.
He is specifically deterred by being locked up. And it's the only way to prevent him from hurting people.
Right. Right. And unfortunately, there are a lot of those people out there. You just have to hope that you don't encounter them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's our responsibility when we have the evidence to make sure a jury understands that.
Yeah.
So how are you feeling, Jenny? Is there anything you think that people need to?
No, I think last time I said that the lesson from this is don't murder people.
That sounds pretty basic.
I mean,
that's a commandment, isn't it?
It's pretty simple, you know. Don't murder people. And I think the thing that makes this case different from others is we have all tried cases that were really tough to try because the police made mistakes in the investigation, or we made mistakes in how we indicted the case or the motions we filed or something, or we lost witnesses or things like that. But this case was well investigated. We had corroborative witnesses. We hadn't made any mistakes in how we indicted it. You know, you expect a case like that just to be a trial that you put up your evidence and then the jury goes back and they come back with a guilty verdict.
I mean, I don't want to say that John Rodman did a good job.
He definitely found something to argue about.
He obviously came up with two arguments that resonated with the jury, which is, you know,
creative.
Yep, that is their job. And of course, our job is to refute it with evidence, which we totally could not have done without Rob Santoro. So tell us, Rob, what do you think that people should take away from this?
A few things. First, John Pujal is my boy. I love him. But Emily, how in the hell did he win your heart? You are so far out of his league. It's unbelievable.
Fair. No, he is the best guy I know, even if he is a pain in the ass sometimes.
Yeah,
but like him because he's exactly like you. He is one of maybe a handful of detectives that I can think of, and you are also in that top 10 of people who won't stop. People who, and you know, I especially say this now, you know, I sit in a different seat in this same judicial system in this same county that you guys were, a different breed of just having no quit and having and being creative and thinking it through and doing the work. And this was a great case. I always had complete faith, and it is much easier to go into a courtroom and just argue your face off when you have complete faith in your investigation.
Yeah,
and I will say I am thankful that when I first got to homicide, John taught me a lot, and he still to this day teaches me stuff. I definitely got mad respect for him. I was just giving him a hard time on the podcast, and he's not here to defend himself, so I got to take some shots.
He'll make sure to go back and listen and hold it against you forever.
I will say this, that if there were ever a time that he could be on the podcast, I would love to have him. There are several people I would love to have that are unavailable to me. And so, until that time, he's going to get shit from basically everybody. I think Allie got him at one point. It's kind of the way things go. But yeah, I'm sorry. Did you have other points, Rob? I think you said there were some.
Yeah. So just a couple other quick ones. I think I mentioned this the last time too, but just as an investigator, no case is too good. I did feel that about this case when I first started. I was like, oh man, like it's a great case. Like, I felt good about it from kind of like the first night. And I was like, this is a done deal, man. And turned out to
You're
be
thinking ground ball.
Yeah.
100%. And like I said, it's the only case I've ever had to try four times. So just crazy. And then the last point just that I wanted to mention was, we did talk about JJ on here, but she's the victim witness advocate, and people like JJ are just so instrumental in so many of these cases. And, we have mentioned them before, but I think it's worth mentioning her here because, she really does such a good job coordinating witnesses, supporting us, but also like never losing sight of the victims. And, I think something in our society now that we lose focus of is victims. There's so much emphasis on all this other stuff, and it's like, that's fine, but I don't know. I think that when you know the name of Samuel Little because he's the most prolific serial killer in the United States, but you don't know Frances Campbell's name, like the woman he killed in Savannah in 1984, like that's a fucking problem. Like, nobody should remember Samuel Little. Nobody should do a fucking news story on Samuel Little. Like, the news story should be on Marshall Polite or Frances Campbell. Like, that's who, like, should be in the news, and that's who should be remembered. Not these fucking guys that are out here hurting people. And that's a problem with our society, I think. And we should start changing that.
Well, and the truth of it is, I think that's been a problem with humankind going back a long time. You talk about Jack the Ripper. I mean, you can look at that kind of, sick fascination.
Yeah. All of them. Gacy Bundy.
Oh, like, yeah.
How many victims can you name of any of them?
Right. Right. And it's horrifying. I mean, but at the same time, just that, I think the fascination is at least in part that you cannot understand how on earth could this person exist. Monsters, like you said, Emily. But you reminded me, Rob, of something that I think is really important about our victim witness advocates. They're totally unsung heroes. We have so many really fantastic people we've worked with. One of them, Helen Bradley, recently wrote a book, and I'm giving her a plug just because I love Helen. And you know, she wrote a book called Breach of Trust that is out recently. I want to have Helen on, honestly.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Because you know, here is somebody who worked with victims for decades and has seen things that we don't even get to see as prosecutors. Mm-hmm. And again, there are a bunch of people I don't have access to, JJ, Yukivia, just so many. I mean, my gosh, we've worked with so many amazing people.
And Helen was working in victim advocacy when it was a new thing.
It existed
when we've all, during our careers.
Right. Shan Spencer created it more or less out of whole cloth in Georgia. And it really is an incredible support to all of us. Everything we do is to have someone who can translate the legalese and some of the stuff that comes out of our mouths after we walk out of the courtroom and we're thinking law, 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 to a victim who's sitting there thinking, what just happened?
And all due respect to victims, but also while the victim witness advocate is being cussed out, being hung up on.
Oh my God. You know,
they're not getting treated nicely by a lot of people.
And JJ took it from Sharon Robbins. I'm just saying that because we did a podcast on Sharon Robbins or Vaughn on Theron's case. And she, man, there were hours on the phone.
Yeah.
Hours on the phone, just like you did, Rob. I mean, I think that there's not enough good stuff that can be said about the people who work as victim advocates, and they have so many cases. It's overwhelming.
They have to deal with a lot of misdirected anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because the
Miss Sharon's my girl, though, man. I think I'd give a lot right now to get a 2-hour phone call from Miss Sharon at like 2 a.m., man. I think that would be pretty cool.
I'll see if some mutual friends can get her to give you a call. How's that?
Perfect. I love Miss Sharon.
I know you do. And I do too, honestly. It's just, the direct dialing got to be a bit much. And totally understandable. But at the same time, there's a lot that we're never going to be able to fix. But I mean, even now, you're never going to fix whatever happened to little Theron. Wow. Anyway, it gets my head going in a bunch of different places, but I agree with all of you that this was a case that is so representative of everything that happens in Savannah over and over and over again. You cannot underestimate good people. I mean, good people in the system, getting the work done, keeping going, and I'm grateful to have worked with all of you. So I hope that people continue to listen. We're going to have more stuff going forward. And I know I've been kind of bad about it, but I hope that we're able to keep going and keep getting the information out there about what this job is, what the truth is, and what needs to be happening in this community and elsewhere. So thank you all for being with us.
As you have heard, the course of true justice, like that of true love, doesn't run smoothly, but perseverance can get the right result, as it did here. And if it hasn't been obvious, in every case we've covered, there are many unsung heroes that make justice possible. From detectives to forensic analysts to prosecutors, all have weight to carry, but one group has been consistently underrepresented: victim advocates. I hope to have longtime victim advocate, author, and friend Helen Bradley on to discuss her work and how it has changed how we fight for victims in Georgia. Stay tuned.